It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about the new government's skills policy, discussing regulating international pathways, and digesting everything that was notable for universities in the King's speech. It's all coming up.
I think there is a tidying up exercise, and there should be sort of a more sort of strategic coordination between parts of the system. But personally, I would not be a fan of sweeping it away and creating a single funder and regulator.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me for the last episode of a season are three fantastic guests as always. In Woburn House, it's Vivian Stern, chief executive at UUK. Vivian, your heart of the week, please.
Oh, I spent yesterday morning at Oxford and yesterday evening at Cranfield and came back properly inspired.
Lovely. And in South London, it's Aaron Porter, chair of the board of BPP University. Aaron, your heart of the week. Is that how we're billing you, Aaron? Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I am today. Hi, everyone. Yes, my highlight of the week was watching the King's speech yesterday. For keen political watchers like me, it's a really fascinating event. You see the personal and the ceremonial. And as a very small aside, seeing someone who I'd worked with, Wes Streeting, get the bill he wanted named, it was actually quite a proud moment.
And in North London, it's Debbie McVitie, Wonky's editor. Debbie, your heart of the week, please.
Well, it certainly wasn't the Euros result, but it was pretty fun to watch the match. I think for me, it's probably coming up this weekend. The choir that I sing in is having an open mic night, so we all get to kind of bust out our solos, and have a drink and have a sort of end of term jolly time. So I'm looking forward to that.
Now we start this week with skills and what we learnt from the King's speech. Debbie, walk us through it.
That's right. So this week in Parliament, the King gave a speech about the new Labour government's legislative agenda for the next year, and we were not expecting, and as such, we were not disappointed that there was no big kind of legislative agenda for higher education. Possibly plenty of policy agendas to discuss, but the big thing that the sector should be paying attention to is the announcement of a Skills England bill. So this has been trailed. We know that there's going to be a new quango. It's going to be called Skills England. It is going to play a coordinating role and a convening role in supporting skills planning at a national level, but also interacting with local provision as well. And it's also going to oversee apprenticeship levy reform. So there's going to be, rather than just employers spending their apprenticeship levy on apprenticeships, Skills England is going to look for high quality technical skills based alternatives and that employers would be given permission to spend money on as well. And this is something employers have been asking for. There's a really good piece on the site from earlier this week looking at what we already know about Skills England. And obviously there's a very much an open question about what the interaction with university and higher education provision will be, and that will all be to come as the legislation unfolds.
So yeah, this is fascinating, isn't it, Vivian? This gives us an indication that kind of skills is the first big area that the government is seriously going to be tackling in the kind of education landscape, or at least the bit of it that touches HE, right?
Yeah, and I think in a sense there were no surprises. We knew this was going to be an early priority. There's been quite a lot of discussion and detail about what they broadly speaking have in mind. There is, I think, for those in the higher education sector, there's always been this slight kind of nervousness that when people talk about skills, they think that that's something that kind of stops, with the FE sector. So, making sure that the understanding of the skills landscape is one which includes that kind of recognition that you get skills at a variety of levels, and universities are absolutely central to providing opportunities to develop skills, particularly at the higher level, but of course they're also heavily involved in many cases in level 4 and 5 and in some cases in other levels. And I think so we need to make sure that this doesn't become a kind of them and us type conversation. And I also have some slight questions about how this interacts with the kind of devolution agenda, because the landscape of combined authorities is a bit patchy, and so there's a question about how this really will begin to play out in places where they don't have that kind of political, you know, the political geography makes it quite hard to do the kind of things you can do where you've got a combined authority.
I've seen some speculation, this is a question for everyone really, but I've seen some speculation that ultimately Skills England is going to be the kind of the major quango for, you know, probably all post-16 education. So, you know, if we move towards a kind of more tertiary landscape, then it would, you know, OFS would probably be subsumed into it. And, you know, this is kind of be where the action is. Is there any kind of grain of truth in any of that?
I mean, I would say in the early sketching of Skills England, that's exactly what seems to be being drawn, something that is cross-cutting in terms of government, almost speaking to the missions that the Labour Party spoke about during the election. This would be the way of addressing inequality, and it touches on skills shortages, bits of immigration, dealing with the industrial strategy, and you could see it as a vehicle for a more joined up tertiary sector. There would be a considerable amount to do to get there, but I think it sets out a direction of travel that will be fascinating to observe over the coming months and years.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend, if Labour ministers called me up tomorrow and said, you know, is that the right way forward? I mean, I'm clearly not first on their call sheet, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend that as a way forward, because I think Skills England should absolutely have a remit to look across the piece. I think that makes absolute sense. And as Viv says, you know, I think that acknowledgement, not only that higher education providers are extremely active in their skills landscape and increasingly so, you know, and providing higher and degree apprenticeships and technical qualifications and all the rest of it, but also that kind of academic vocational divide, you know, there's you know, yet another chance to try and kind of unpack that and sort of recognize that really it's a bit of a false dichotomy. But I also do think that the sorts of things that Skills England is going to do around forecasting and perhaps commissioning and coordinating is rather different from than direct regulation of providers. And I think you still need a regulatory body. I think you could arguably say that you need a single regulatory body for further and higher education, doing things around quality, access, you know, and making sure that providers are kind of, you know, providing the, you know, the quality and what's required, and that they are financially sustainable and well governed. I would worry about making a single entity responsible for the whole gamut. That actually, I think there might be a kind of case for saying that there's, you know, there should be one coordinating body and one regulating body.
Well, I mean, I think Debbie's right. I think that, first of all, I mean, there's just a small pragmatic part of me that thinks that given everything else we have got on and actually the ambitions that the government has set, the last thing we want to do is take a regulator that's just been sort of, you know, spent the last 5 years getting established and frankly, you know, annoying a lot of people in the process, but is starting to show that it's sort of getting to grips with some of the things that we need to see improved in the way it interacts with the higher education sector. And the idea that you kind of sweep that all again away and you spend another 5 or more years designing a new integrated tertiary funder and regulator just fills me with a little bit of dread. I would rather build on what we've got. I think that there is a way of achieving the kind of articulation and integration that the government wants, and perhaps, you know, would be in the interests of the whole country without thinking that you have to have a kind of super regulator. What we do need is better sort of coordination between regulators, because at the moment, I think one of the things that really frustrates universities is that they will have to meet the different requirements of multiple regulators. It's obviously particularly an issue in relation to things like the degree apprenticeships, where you've got Ofsted on the pitch, which, you know, is not necessarily designed to recognise the kind of university landscape and OFS doing different things. So I think there is a tidying up exercise, and there should be sort of a more sort of strategic coordination between parts of the system. But personally, I would not be a fan of sweeping it away and creating a single funder and regulator.
And briefly, I'd just say this discussion we've had actually is going to be replicated across all parts of government. And one of the challenges for the new government is going going to be this dilemma between delivery versus sort of dealing with kind of architecture and structure. And if too long is spent on architecture and structure, then actually it's the months and the years start to be worn away. And Labour will realise that they have to start delivering in order to get the right sort of judgment that they will be looking to seek in 4 years from now.
I was just going to say that I think that one of the things that we've been saying on the kind of finances of the sector is, can you stop making it worse? Like, if you can't help us, could you at least try not to make it worse? And I think
that message has been received. I've got.
So you know, the focus should be trying to strip out unnecessary burden, streamline, you know, make sure people can spend in universities as much of the pound they receive for teaching on teaching, and as little as possible on satisfying the absolutely necessary demands of, you know, accountability. So I would say just go into it with that mindset. You haven't got a lot of money to splash around, so think about how you can save money, you know, in the kind of delivery end of stuff.
I think that's completely right. And I think we should never really underestimate just the absolute, and actually we saw it with the creation of the Office for Students. You know, it just took a long time to transfer, to create this new organization, to build a regulatory system, to, you know, consult on all the different aspects of it, and to kind of establish a way of working that continues to be quite contested. And, you know, so I think that kind of journey towards maturity needs to be kind of baked into any kind of policy making that occurs. And I think there's very much scope for OFS to adapt to a slightly different environment.
It's worth saying, of course, that Wales is on that journey right now, that the tertiary Education Commission is now a thing, and it's going to be interesting to see how that develops. And Scotland obviously has signalled that it wants to go on the same path.
I think the other thing to log as well is the extent to which colleges, of course, are already struggling with that, needing to report to Ofsted, to the Institute for Apprenticeships and Technical Education, the Education and Skills Funding Agency. So there's lots of different actors in the college sector, and that I think is where there's an awful lot of scope for streamlining and thinking. And I think one of the kind of useful things that will happen, Labour's promise to elevate colleges to the kind of status of sort of technical excellence providers. I forget the exact nomenclature, but I think, you know, the real focus in this area should be about saying, let's look at the bits of the system that need a bit of support to achieve the sorts of things we might want them to, and kind of put them on a kind of equal footing with other providers in the area, and then we can kind of see what that regulatory environment might look like.
So the other area here that's really interesting to see how this might all fit together is the LLE, of course, and how that might be integrated with this skills policy and what Labour might do with it. I mean, do we have any sense yet, Debbie, about where that's all going to go?
No, but I mean, I very highly commend a piece on the site that Michael Salmon wrote, where he just sort of parses out all the different kind of things that would need to be in place. I think where we are now is it is legally possible for the Secretary of State to set the fee at the level of a credit, and that power might be useful to the current government. But in terms of the actual kind of practical rollout of the LLE, the creation of the website where you kind of log in and you can see what your entitlement is, and the kind of expectation that the courses will be offered in a certain way, and I do think it relatively unlikely that will just sort of roll out as planned, because in the context of setting up new bodies, of thinking about those these new statutory local growth plans that universities will need to be involved in, and colleges too, and employers and everyone else, it just doesn't make sense to pursue this kind of one aspect of what is probably going to end up being a larger skills agenda, and that doesn't really achieve much in the way of Labour's broader objectives. There's no evidence, I think, that making provision modular improves productivity, or there's not been enormous demand for short courses for accessing loan finance in this way. So I think the fact that the law exists, that it is possible to chunk up courses in that way may end up being useful, but I don't think it makes a lot of policy sense to just sort of say, let's push forward with this kind of specific reform outside the context of all the other things that we might wish to do.
What's your message, Vivian, to the new ministers when you're talking to them about this when it comes up?
There are two things. I mean, first of all, I think that Debbie's right. You know, considering how this fits into a kind of broader agenda, clearly Labour's going to want a little bit of time to do that. They were always supportive of the LLE. We are also. There is a short-term issue which they need to take seriously, which is that a whole bunch of institutions are busy sort of reformulating their systems and processes in order to configure themselves to deal with the way that the student loans company has now reshaped how it works to implement the LLE. So it's kind of happening. I mean, I was talking to somebody at the Open University who says they've already spent £250,000 on it, and the next wave of that expenditure is sort of now starting to be, the commitments are starting to be made. So I wouldn't want there to be a very long period of uncertainty. But I do think it is a moment in which we can take stock of whether, you know, the LLE in the way that it was conceived by the previous government works. I mean, for me, it's also an opportunity to start, pushing the level 7 point again, because I think the real demand for modular provision might be at level 7. I think there could be a real opportunity for people who have left full-time education, they're midway through their careers, and they're looking to acquire skills to effectively equip them to deal with a labour market that will be radically changed in many cases by technologies like AI. So I think perhaps opening that up will be quite important.
Okay, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Gemma Ahern, and along with Lisa Anderson, we've got an article in Wonky this week about building belonging into the curriculum through grand challenges. We believe that we need to be working together in holistic teams, with academics working alongside professional services colleagues, including librarians, employability and enterprise staff, student experience and student welfare teams, and academic developers. We also believe this involves a shift in mindset and practice. It's about understanding university education as a third space, a space for social interaction and transformation. And this is particularly important as students are going through this cost of living crisis, with more students working long hours, more students having chronic illness, disabilities, care and responsibilities, and using and engaging with higher education in different ways than before. We recognise that we need to be doing things differently, and that doesn't mean doing more, but using our resources in a different way. We need to adapt our teaching to the changing needs of students in this post-pandemic, post-disaster period. And we need to ensure that we address student belonging and community within our curriculum design.
Now, QAA is back looking into pathway programmes. Aaron, talk us through what's going on here.
Yes, that's right. I mean, listeners and readers will remember that earlier this year, at the beginning of this year, there was a great deal of emphasis on international student entry into the sector and pathway programmes specifically. And they came under quite a bit of heat, in part from some investigative journalism from the Sunday Times, which in truth, I think, was part of the wider debate that was being had about immigration. And there were questions being raised about whether the rigor and standards that international students that were being subject to were really fair or as rigorous as they needed to be. I think there were some genuine questions raised, and there was some wider stirring of the pot around immigration. Sensibly, the sector, commissioned by Universities UK, the Quality Assurance Agency, actually tried to understand what has been going on over the last few months. And earlier this week, they have produced a report that actually tries to paint a picture of what the international foundation program picture looks like. And the evidence, I think, is that there are there's been a largely clean bill of health for the sector, and that there is a broad equivalence between the requirements for pathway programs and their home student equivalents. But I think it does mean that there's been a lot of emphasis on this area. And I think there is a genuine discussion to be had about what sorts of pathways international students should be able to access in order to gain entry into higher education programs in the UK. But it's been welcome that this has been given some serious examination, and I think we can have a more evidence-based discussion going forward.
Vivian, I feel like this is probably one of those things that should come with a trigger warning for you after the that series of stuff in the papers all those months ago. But what do you make of it?
Oh, it's a very funny thing. Like, the whole thing has had moments of a bit of kind of high octane drama. And we commissioned this review because when the Sunday Times stories broke, we first of all we thought they were inaccurate. And I should say that we submitted a very, very detailed complaint to the Independent Press Standards authority about that series of articles, which still has not concluded, or their process haven't concluded, but we thought it was inaccurate. Having said that, we can't afford to ignore as a sector any suggestion that there is some degree of unfairness in the way that international students are admitted. And so the decision that we took very rapidly was, let's not be defensive. If you think there might be an issue, let's open the bonnet and have a look. And if something isn't right, we should fix it. And so that's why we commissioned the QAA. We also, we did two other things. We reviewed the Fair Admissions Code. And that, as you know, is a kind of sector-wide commitment around the sort of admission standards, which is sort of part of something that we've been working on probably now for two decades. And we also opened up the agent quality framework, and we're making that more robust. So it was really intended to signal, look, we think this article is misleading, but if you're worried, we're going to have a look. And if there is a problem, we'll do something about it. I got, really quite nervous just before we saw the report, because, of course, we didn't get any insight into what it was going to find until the thing was basically ready to share with the wider world and journalists. And I did spend one evening last week saying to my husband, what have I done? It's a terrible mistake. I'm going to get fired. Because, you know, of course, there's a chance that you commission something like this and says, yeah, the whole thing is totally rotten. And, you know, everybody's out there behaving like cowboys. And the membership, you can imagine the kind of combined membership swiveling to look at you and going, and, you know, whose bright idea was this? It's fortunate, perhaps, therefore, that the QAA, I mean, to be honest, from my point of view, it's ideal, because the QAA does not find that there is nothing to see here. It does point to two areas where I think the sector needs to pay a bit of attention. The first is this question of, you know, the balance between the kind of pathways that are available to international students and the pathways that are available to domestic students. And it points out that, you know, there are more opportunities that do seem to be kind of more pathways for international students. We might think there are good reasons for that, including the fact that the last government capped foundation program fees, which doesn't incentivize provision. But that's something that we need to pay attention to. The other is assessment practice. So if you can take an assessment multiple times, is that right? Is it fair? I mean, of course, these pathways are different from A-levels. So, you know, if you think about language competence, you expect people's language competence to develop over time. So maybe it is fair if you're kind of allowing people to take multiple resits as they improve. But we need people to sort of pay attention to that, I think. And there are some other funny things, like the kind of, there isn't a consistent pattern around progression, either from international or domestic programs. But so you can find things that where equivalent programs have higher rates of progression for domestic students, and otherwise where the progression rates are higher for international students. So again, through the Fair Admissions Code, we're going to be asking people to think again about, do their pathways, you know, how are the kind of progression rates looking, and is there a need to review that? So it's not that there's nothing to see, but broadly speaking, it confirms that there is an equivalence and that standards are being maintained. So I think I'll keep my job. job, but it was one of those things where it was either brave in a good way or it was brave in a kind of Sir Humphrey, very brave minister way.
Sure. Well, I think it was brave in a good way, Viv. but then again, my job wasn't on the line. I think it's really important that the sector shows confidence in itself, right? You know, like sort of says, you know, if we behave as if we think there might be something wrong here, that's a problem in itself, isn't it? Because we need, and that's the reason we have the quality processes and all the rest of it. You know, and the reason Universities UK gets to say our quality is world leading because it genuinely is. But I do think it was the right call, and yes, it's jolly good that nothing too kind of hairy crawled out from under the rock. But I think also the timing's quite good, isn't it? Obviously the sector is very much looking towards the new government to at the very least issue some warm words on international students. And actually I think Bridget Phillipson on World at One, the Secretary of State, did offer some warm words on international recruitment and sort of said, you know, the graduate route works very successfully, and pointed to her constituency in Sunderland and you know, the kind of positive impact that it's had. And that's the sort of attitude that the sector is really hoping to see from the Labour government. And I think, you know, being able to show, as Aaron said, you know, in an evidence-based way, that the sector is not only that, you know, that there's no evidence of consistently bad practice around things like pathway programs, that where there are questions about possible kind of opportunities to improve practice, that the sector is willing to grasp that nettle, I think will make it an awful lot easier for the Labour government to do what it might want to do around relaxing the rhetoric on international students, and potentially over time, you know, relaxing the policy environment as well, because I think the sector could, you know, very badly needs a degree of consistency to be able to kind of create that sustainable recruitment.
There are, though, quite interesting competing tensions though already emerging in this, because on the one hand, we're told that, I mean, Bridget Phillipson said this week that, international students, the sector recruiting more is part of the solution, at least, to the financial sustainability problem. So we don't expect them to kind of go backwards in terms of policy on that, and the mood music and the rhetoric is going to be better. So that's good on one level, although it doesn't solve the funding problem. But we're also sort of hearing that they know that regulation has got too expensive and burdensome, as Vivian said earlier, and the sector would be better, more efficient pound for pound with less of that. But there also has to be kind of better regulation across different parts of the landscape, including in the things that touch international student recruitment. So it's quite tricky, isn't it, to see how you navigate a path through slimming down a burden, improving the regulation, and also allowing universities the freedom to be able to, you know, do the things they want to do, like recruit international students. So it's a tricky one, isn't it, Viv?
I think it's about making sure you're regulating the right things in the right way. And I think there's been a great tendency under the previous government when, you know, there is a kind of, for some reason, a focus on something that appears to be not right in the higher education sector to reach too quickly for the regulatory lever. I mean, registration on harassment, which I think we're expecting to see next week, some of the way that the regulatory machinery has been used to deal with freedom of speech. You can be very strongly of the view that universities need to evolve in the way they manage free speech on campus. I think everybody has had a kind of, you know, a huge, I think there are a lot of people in university leadership positions who've done the equivalent of a master's in freedom of speech over the course of the last few months. But you can still think that's important and not think that it's the right topic for the regulator to be focusing on. But on international students, you know, I think where regulation does become important is where you've got financial motives, and there are financial motives around international student recruitment, which could, if unchecked, lead to poor behaviour. And it's in our interest as a sector to make sure that there is public trust trust and confidence in the international student regime. And that means making sure that we've got eyes in the back of our head for things that are weaknesses or vulnerabilities in the system, and that we take ownership of it. And I think if we can be seen to do that effectively, it'll be easier for government to resist the temptation to reach for a regulatory lever.
I mean, it's also about maturity of relationship, isn't it? Because, you know, if you can say, let's take the time that we need, no one's talking years here, the QA was able to conduct this review in a matter of months. Where there is a question, let's take the time we need, let's look at the evidence, and then let's have a sensible conversation about it, with a shared understanding that international recruitment is fundamentally a good thing, and that kind of knee-jerk responses and defensiveness doesn't signal a mature relationship. If government and universities can be aligned on the principle that a sustainable flow of international students into the UK brings all kinds of benefits, then it becomes about saying, what does sustainable mean? How do we regulate that space in a way that kind of leaves that freedom open to innovate and do things, but also protect students and their experience and make sure that they are getting what they are paying for, and that is a positive experience on all sides. And that is a really constructive conversation, and one that I think the sector will be up for, but in the context of an agreement that this is, the overall goal is to sustain and grow that part of the sector.
It's been the King's Speech this week, setting out the government's legislative agenda. Vivian, tell us what's in it.
So there are 40 bills, and there are some that are very obviously relevant to the education sector, including the Skills Bill and the Renters' Rights Bill and the English Devolution Bill. But there are also a bunch of things in there that somebody somewhere will want to be reading very carefully, and I nominate wonky. Although actually I'm a bit of a kind of legislation wonk, so I'll probably quite enjoy it. So there are a few bills in there that we might have some stake in. I mean, I'll be interested in the National Wealth Fund Bill and the Pensions Bill. There's a Sustainable Aviation Fuel Bill, which makes me think there's some niche interest there for somebody. But there are also a few others that I think we just need to basically watch how they develop. So there's a mental health bill, there's a draft equality bill, and there is a border security, asylum and immigration bill. And I think you just have to watch what could be tacked on to some of those things and how they might affect a sector that's not perhaps paying them full attention.
Right. So lots and lots here, 40 bills, as you say. Aaron, what caught your eye?
Well, I was really struck by the English Devolution Bill, because in a way it's so cross-cutting and potentially quite significant. The genesis of what's being proposed is the ability for local leaders, local mayors and others to be giving jurisdiction to make decisions, obviously affect their communities with regard to boosting economic growth, thinking about transport, thinking about local skills plans. And of course, there are significant implications, much of which is direct to our higher education sector. I would certainly think in relation to economic growth and in terms of skills, but actually in terms of wider things like infrastructure and health and transport, there are really significant roles for our universities. Now, at this stage, we don't really know what the sort of infrastructure will look like for how this will roll out, but I think it will put our higher education sector on alert, which is that there is a role for them to really roll up their sleeves, engage with their local civic communities, and engage and their local governments and mayoralties to think about how they can help drive this forward in a way that could be helping to drive prosperity and spreading that around the country, which is clearly what is intended in this bill.
Yeah, fascinating. Debbie, which bill jumped out at you?
Well, I think something that will have a level of impact on universities, but perhaps hasn't been kind of discussed in any depth, probably because we don't really have the precise nature of the detail at this point, is the Employment Rights Bill. And this derives from the New Deal for Working People that Labour has been in the run up to the election agreeing with unions and getting over the line, and that will make provision, for example, for new employees to have certain rights from day one. At the minute, there's a sort of 2-year grace period within which employees don't accrue rights. particular rights around firing and so on. And they would have access to rights from kind of, you know, point of hiring. So there will need to be a kind of way of thinking about, you know, detaching relationships that aren't working out in a way that kind of maintains people's rights. There is an intent to ban 0 hours contracts. And obviously that has bearing on all kinds of hiring practices in the sector. Some genuinely problematic, and some that are designed to deliver flexibility and the ability of universities to navigate the difference. I think will be there will need to be a bit of sort of thinking around that. There'll be new legislation ruling back some of the legislation around industrial relations that we saw under the last government. So things like requiring physical ballots for industrial action and that sort of thing, so that could have a bearing particularly in a sector that's seen quite a lot of industrial action over the last few years.
Yeah, lots in that one. Vivian, what you give us another bill that you like.
So I'm picking out the mental health bill, because although at first sight it probably doesn't feel like in the description of what the bill will do that there is necessarily a direct impact on the higher education sector, I think given that the Liberal Democrats have a manifesto commitment to introduce a statutory duty of care, and given that Labour, although they sort of didn't really pin their colours to the mast on this when it was debated in the last Parliament, I just wonder whether we'll find that there's a big push for a statutory duty of care to be attached to this bill. So that's one of those things where I think when a piece of legislation goes through Parliament, it will be amended and there will be debates about things that aren't currently in it. So the bill itself is really implementing the recommendations of the Wesley report, which was a 2017 report on the need to reform the legislation around the kind of basically the balance of power between the patient and the care system. So there are all sorts of things that relate, for example, to detention under the Mental Health Act and the way that people with learning disabilities can be treated and strengthening the voice of patients. But the thing that we should be watching out for is for this to be another opportunity for those people who would really like to see universities introduce a statutory duty of care to make the case again. And from the Universities UK point of view, I think this is an issue which I'm sure we'll debate more. But we don't think that's the right way forward for a variety of reasons.
Could I give an honourable mention to the Digital Information and Smart Data Bill? Because again, I think its implications for higher education in terms of the use of data, but again, right across the economy, could be really quite profound. Again, I think we're at the foothills of understanding what this could mean. The implications and interface with artificial intelligence as well. So I think this could be something that really becomes quite significant over the coming months.
And the terrorism bill has some implications, doesn't it, Vivian?
Yeah, so this is the Martin's Law bill, which will require public venues to have in place measures to mitigate the risks of terrorist incidents. I think there'll be some scaling. So for very large, for institutions that have large public venues, I think the implications could be quite significant. But there is an intention that it should be proportionate. And again, I think this is something where we really need to try and understand what kind of venues will be affected, how will they be affected, and are there any particular issues for the higher education sector that are different from the issues that will affect venues of very small scale in general. And I think that's going to be, that'll be something that we all end up talking a lot about too. So like I took a maximalist approach to kind of, should we be thinking about this? So obviously the King's Speech also talks about the formation of the Industrial Strategy Council. That is something we want to be super hooked into. I wonder whether there are opportunities around the creation of the National Wealth Fund. There's obviously a bit of an opportunity around the Planning and Infrastructure Bill, if you think about the university infrastructure and how planning might be a barrier to doing things that, you know, would be great for both institutions, the research base and the economy. I mentioned this Sustainable Aviation Fuel Bill, where I basically kind of read that and I thought, why do you need legislation to do that? But it's basically about accelerating the kind of transition to clean aviation. And I know there are a couple of universities, I happened to be at Cranfield yesterday, so this was in my mind, that you know, have enormous expertise in that area. So what will that mean? And then there's a digital information and smart data bill. No idea what that will be about. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other things like the cybersecurity and resilience bill, which has been mentioned, that I think, again, you just want to read and make sure you understand what they're doing and try and think laterally. And I suppose the sort of opportunist in me also thinks maybe there are some things that will be going through Parliament that will be opportunities to put our issues on the table a bit.
I think actually I do have one. It's pensions. Yeah. And my goodness, that's a sort of, you know, deeply technical area, but it's something that's been a real challenge for the sector. So the kind of the provision of the bill, and this is actually something that was an agenda under the last government, and it pops up in you know, various kind of people writing about how do we make things work better, is using these sort of enormous pension pots that have been accrued. So at the minute, they're all just sort of sitting, you know, accruing very modest interest in very, very safe investments. Actually, that you know, all of that capital could be deployed in the interest of economic growth. Now, one of the consequences of that, of course, is that you might be using that capital investment in a riskier way. But if the government is able to do things to potentially increase the returns on pensions investments, then that has potentially a knock-on impact on the affordability of pension schemes. And of course, that is something that the sector will be paying extremely close attention to.
So that's about it for this week and indeed this season. To dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to stay ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do make sure to subscribe to our briefing and intelligence services. Details are on the site. So thanks very much to Vivian, Debbie and Aaron and Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back in September. Until then, enjoy this musical retrospective of the last government's HE agenda from the Wonky House Band. And of course, stay wonky.
David Willetts, Lord Brown, grinning, public spending down 9K. No way, I'm so sorry, Nick. Corin, margin, AAB, offer and hefty. White paper, bursaries, and sell the lumber quick. Burgess on transcripts, shooting number, cat lit. Grant, grow HE reviewers, shifting quality. Joe Johnson, filter test, Miliband ain't tough enough. Ref assessed, OFS accelerate decrease. No Wesley, O'Dana, no detriment, strike, Slater, Brexit, Times, turn review, and Theresa May. HE bill, framework drafts, DfE gets unis back, tertiary and technical, and maybe PQA. Michael Barber, Bell Review, apprenticeships and fees up to culture wars, mobility, industrial strategy. Snap election, TEF 1, MPs get Brexit done, registration backlog, and high pay for VCs. Information, regulation, free speech and great inflation, fiscal illusions, ONS, Sam FEMA defect. Not appointing Toby Young, PQA is still wrong, civic roles and funding go, conditional regrets. Lifelong learning, A&P, Skidmore launching D3, Orgelands, global plans, TEF needs a review. Strike action once again, axing plans for learning gain, Boris Johnson, PM and leaving the EU. By Horizon, Newcastle is still rising. Discover Uni, ARPA bills and platforms in SU. Election time is here once more, stoking up the culture wars, leveling up LLE skills and HTQ. Lockdown, COVID ready, sparrow squashing, cases steady, furlough, travel window refunds, no. New normal, party gate, roads, falls, outbreaks, resignations, low value, and Boris has to go. The
Michelle is secretary for a day. Liz Truss is on her way. Auger answers, Teff is back, and Jenkins middle finger snap. Boots on the ground and Mickey Mouse last seen at the Queen's house. Mini budget lettuce leans ready for Sunak. Tech bros and AI live in fear of Plan 5. LLE will be delayed. Ref again and strikes on pay. Ukraine, cost of living, data futures hits the floor. Look, you ain't you calling you wars, and I can't take it anymore.